This evening I'd like to speak about the liberated mind. The great Zen master Dogen once said that meditation is to study oneself. To study oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to be awakened by all things. To be awakened by all things is to let body and mind of self and others fall away. Now the liberation of mind and heart is truly the essence of Buddhist teaching. And everything that we do in this practice is actually in the service of liberation, of freedom. We're learning in our practice how to heal and release those places of conflict and struggle and contractedness that can live in our heart and mind. We're learning how to release the fears, the grasping, the conflicts. We're basically learning all of the time about how to liberate misunderstanding and how to liberate separation and alienation, essentially through the development of wisdom. We're learning how to release anger and fear, mostly through the development of loving kindness and compassion. In a very real way, we could say that this path is actually a journey of undoing. In a way, it's really a pathway of untangling the knots of misunderstanding that keep us tied to a feeling of contractedness or fear. In mindfulness practice, we're very much encouraged to know when our mind and heart feel contracted or distracted. We're encouraged to know when our mind is affected by wanting, by anger, by unconsciousness. We're also encouraged to know when the mind and heart are filled with appreciation, with loving kindness, with compassion. And when our mind is rooted in equanimity, in calmness, in peace, we're also encouraged to know when the mind is liberated. Now, the unliberated mind we may feel that we are all too familiar with. But this question of what does a liberated mind actually look like may feel quite a puzzle. The liberated mind is a mind that doesn't stick to anything. It doesn't cling to anything. It's a mind that doesn't have any boundaries. It's not defined by anything, nor does it tend to define anything. The liberated mind, we might say, is a mind that's not fooled. It's not deceived by anything at all, and it's hooked nowhere. It's a mind of unshakable receptivity, fluidity, and openness. Certainly, we would say that the liberated mind does not suffer, that it is radiant, light, and immeasurable. Now, when we listen to things like this, of course our first thought is that this liberated mind is probably pretty far away from this mind that I'm experiencing on a moment-to-moment level. We might think of the liberated mind as being some other creature or belonging to somebody else or something inaccessible. And we often think of the liberated mind as something to gain, and yet it is not. It is not something to gain or attain. In essence, the liberated mind is really not going to be found anywhere else, except in this mind we are experiencing right now. And that liberated mind is also, it's not dependent on taming, on subduing, on overcoming, or of transcending this mind. But the liberated mind is found through the ways that we learn to liberate this very mind and heart from its own veils of confusion and agitation. You know, when you think of this mind now, but sometimes so busy, so agitated, so rocky, so full, that is simply the mind of the Buddha with amnesia. It's nothing else. It's just the mind of the Buddha with amnesia. You've forgotten. And so we are learning to remember, to recollect. Mindfulness practice is sometimes called the practice of recollection. The practice of recollection. Recollecting what is actually true. And even all of that agitation, all of that restlessness and busyness we sometimes experience is in itself a reflection of emptiness and a reflection of freedom. I think it is, you know, we use this word emptiness all of the time in the Buddhist tradition. And I understand also in the Talmudic tradition we have this word emptiness. And I think it is very important to understand that emptiness is not a state. It's not even just a personal understanding or an insight into our personal world. Emptiness is also not the absence of anything. You know, sometimes, or very often perhaps, when we think of emptiness, we think in terms of empty rooms, empty glasses, empty plates, empty boxes. That's how we think of emptiness, as something being gone. And then when we think of emptiness as being the absence of something, of course we can fall into this very futile and unnecessary work of trying to get rid of things, trying to get rid of thoughts, trying to get rid of feelings, trying to get rid of objects. But I think a more important question is to ask ourselves, what does emptiness look like in a full room? What does emptiness look like in a full glass, in a full box, in a full plate, in a full mind? What does emptiness look like there? Where it's not dependent upon getting rid of anything at all. Personally, I always think that nature is a great friend, a great ally in understanding the nature of emptiness. When we really look at nature, the natural world around us, what we see, of course, is this ongoing fluidity, this process of change, don't we? Nothing stays the same. Everything is always changing. We see the arising and passing of the seasons, the way that spring changes into summer and then gradually into fall, gradually into winter, into spring again. We see the birds building their nests and laying their eggs and then those birds flying away. We see the leaves on the trees fall and turn into another kind of abundance. Sometimes I think, you know, when we plant a bulb, a flower bulb in the garden, you know, and we can look at it, nothing seems to happen for months at a time. And yet even when it's invisible to us, that flower bulb, of course, is in the process of turning into something else. Soon the bulb appears as a flower. The flower gradually wilts. It falls away. Now, when that flower appears, it's not exactly the same as the bulb, is it? You look at them, the flower is not exactly the same as the bulb. Even when nothing seems to be happening for months, when that bulb is in the ground, it is in the process of turning into something else. Yet the flower is also not separate from the bulb, is it? I mean, a daffodil bulb doesn't turn into a rose. It is something different and yet not separate. What we see is an ongoing process of arising and passing and change. When we also look closely at nature, at the natural world, we probably see that nobody is actually making all of this happen. That everything appears and fades away because of conditions. The condition of the soil, the bulb, the sun, the water, the person who planted it. All of these conditions come together in order for this process of flowering to happen. Now, if we change the conditions, you know, if we took away the water or we put a different kind of soil, it's not as if nothing would happen. It's just that a different process would occur. A different formation would appear. Now, this process that is so clear in nature is, of course, that is no different than the process that is happening everywhere, the cycles of arising and passing because of conditions. We can't find anything in life that is independent of it. That process we see in nature, of course, is also happening in our own nature, our own body, our own minds, our own feelings, in everything we see and hear and touch and experience. We see the seasons of change, of arising and passing. We were once a baby. We turned into a child. We turned into a teenager, into an adult. We will age and we will die. You know, the elderly me is not exactly the same as the baby me, but they're not exactly totally different either. What we see is the same process. The seasons of our own lives. We see too the formations, the appearances of our thoughts, of our feelings, of our memories, of our emotions, and they too arise and pass because of conditions. The other day I came out of the office and I saw one of It's amazing to me that so many places where you have meditation retreats have dogs. So I have this whole catalog of dog stories, and I got a new one here to add to it. The other day I came out of the office, and one of the dogs was lying by the office door, and it was when I first got here, actually. And I looked at the dog lying down at the outside the office door, and I saw it had this huge tumor growth growing at the top of his head. And my first feeling, I could see this is feeling, perception, consciousness. My first feeling was one of kind of being taken aback. And then the perception came, oh, the poor dog. And then there was one or two other little thoughts there about, you know, I wonder if this dog's getting taken care of with its tumor, you know. Then I thought, no, this poor dog, somebody's taking care of it. So I spent some time in the morning just extending metta towards this dog. It was really quite nice, you know, may this dog be well, may this dog be happy. And then I came down to the office just before lunch, and I looked over at the dog, and it was sitting up beside its tumor, beside its growth. And the tumor was a rock. Was the rock outside of the office door. But the way the dog had been lying, it was the same color, and it looked like it was growing out of his head. So much to my surprise, I say, here's the dog sitting beside its tumor. This dog is actually perfectly all right. It's not to say that my morning of metta had been wasted. Of course it had not. It was a wonderful morning of metta. However, it was to me of an illustration of how appearances can be mistaken for reality. And we experience this all the time, with the conditions there giving rise to a certain appearance, and we certainly experience it within ourselves. You know, we have a thought about someone maybe we've struggled with in our lives. It arrives, pops up in the meditation. There it is. And we can see the memory or the association come in. We can see the feeling arising. You put those together and you have something we call anger that will last as long as those conditions last. And then it turns into something else. You walk by the kitchen and maybe you smell something cooking. Maybe you smell garlic. There's the body to smell it, the smell that's there, the mind to identify it, the like or the association, and you might very well have the formation of the body, your body, arriving in the dining room an hour before lunch is served. You put together the condition of a body sensation in your knee. Maybe you have aversion or fear around it. The thinking of it, about it. You put all of that together and you have the formation of the suffering meditator. You put together the sound, you know, perhaps the mind identifies it as a mosquito. You have the feeling, perhaps the anger or the anxiety, you have the hand reaching out. It's a formation. You put all those conditions together and what we have is our appearance or the appearance of something in that moment that we sometimes call reality. Sometimes the ways our formations come together, our sense of who we are and what the world is in that moment, we welcome with acceptance. But sometimes we also see the way that we can accept the changes and formations of nature far more easily than we accept the changes and the formations within our own being. There's a poem by a Zen master. It said, "We accept the graceful falling of mountain cherry blossoms, but it is much harder for us to fall away from our own attachment to appearances." Something else that we see as we really look closely at nature is that we see that all of the different changes within nature are not really doing that much arguing with themselves. You know, the emerging shoot of the daffodil is not kind of saying, "Oh, I can't wait to be a beautiful flower that everybody will admire." The daffodil doesn't long to be a rose. When the daffodil begins to wilt and fade away, it's not shouting and saying, "Wait, this shouldn't be happening. I should last longer." But in the seasons and the changes and the shifts and the formations in our own lives, sometimes we do a lot of arguing. We say, "This shouldn't be happening. It should last longer." Sometimes there's a huge gap between what we think of what should be happening and what is happening. We sometimes have a long list of likes and dislikes and ways that we judge and measure all our ideas of what should be, who I should be, who you should be. We also have all the descriptions of who I am and who you are. And sometimes the waterfall of agitation and restlessness that follows in the wake of our descriptions. We tend to describe ourselves and to describe others and to describe the world by their appearance. And in all of those descriptions and our long list of likes and dislikes, really things don't seem very empty, do they? They seem very, very full. And the ease that we see in nature, the arising and passings, we don't always see that reflected in our own experience. Now, we often get caught in things. we find ourselves kind of struggling with the world of feelings, the world of sounds and sights and thoughts. We sometimes find ourselves struggling with our ideas and images of who we are, and we do at times suffer. Why? I mean, have you asked yourself, why do I suffer? This is a really good question. You know, I once saw somebody wearing a t-shirt in California that said, suffering is optional. It's not a bad idea to go with for a while. You know, it's not a bad time to say, you know, why do I suffer? I mean, is it really necessary? Is that, you know, our kind of life sentence? You know, do we just see that as a kind of given, that that's what it means to be a human being, is that you suffer? Well, no, it's not necessary, actually. The reason why suffering is introduced into this world of arising and passing is because another condition is introduced. And that condition, we might say, is clinging or holding. Identification or grasping, whatever word we choose to use. That movement when we try to fix something by how it appears, when we fix it with our concepts, that is clinging. It's the movement to fix something in space and time and to give it an identity separate and apart from all else. Nagarjuna, Stephen read from Nagarjuna this morning, once said that clinging is to insist on being someone. Not to cling is to be free to be no one. Clinging is to insist on being someone. Not to cling is to be free to be no one. That's not easy for us to feel comfortable with. You know, there's a line from a movie I saw recently. The person said, I would rather be a pretend somebody than an authentic nobody. Because it's not easy for us to be comfortable with it. We might say that clinging and holding is the condition for amnesia. That clinging and holding is the condition for forgetting freedom. And that non-clinging, non-identification, is the condition for remembering freedom, for resting in emptiness. And the Buddha once said that emptiness is the abode or the home of the great person. When we identify with a thought, what we think, we become. When we identify with agitation, we become agitated. When we identify with an unpleasant thought, we become negative. When we identify with a guilty thought, we become guilty. We forget who we were before that thought arose, don't we? It's like that's forever. That's now who I am. We've forgotten who we were before that thought arose. We identify with a feeling, and that is what we become. We cling to a feeling of anger. We become angry. We cling to a feeling of impatience. We become impatient. We cling to a feeling of judgment. We become judgmental. Who were we before that feeling arose? Were we just the same? No. We were quite different. We might have been clinging to something else, but we were quite different. So we had a different appearance. We identify with an experience, and the experiencer is formed, and we say, now I'm better, now I'm worse, I'm improving, I'm failing, I'm enjoying, I'm suffering. Who were we before we found some way to fix ourselves separate and apart from anything else? The appearance is mistaken for the truth. And then we've got this long monologue that goes on, you know, to kind of almost make that appearance even more fixed. You know, we've identified with sadness, and we've got a whole long history, a whole lifetime of reasons why we should be sad. You know, we identify with anger, and boy, can we ever think of a lot of reasons why we should be angry? You know, we could go on all day. Then we make the story to make that even more fixed. Of course, we not only fix ourselves, we fix others. You are like this. You are my friend. You are my ally. You are my enemy. You are my opponent. All of the words that attach themselves to our view of reality. Do we see change in those formations, or do we find ourselves believing so strongly in our descriptions? Now, we see that some of those appearances and some of those beliefs, they change so quickly. You know, we can sit over breakfast, you know, and we're mindfully, happily enjoying our breakfast, and, you know, we think, oh, finally I've arrived, you know, I've had a breakthrough, you know. And we're sitting there enjoying that, and then, you know, somebody spills their porridge on our foot, and we completely forget it, you know. We become, oh, no, I'm the agitated, angry, impatient meditator, you know, that is going to be forever. We might do a metta sitting, you know, and we come out, oh, we love the world, you know. We love everybody, you know, until somebody trips over our foot or something, and then there we are again, and now I am like this. It goes on so quickly, so quickly. But some of the ways that we fix ourselves are actually not so changing so quickly. They have this whole long history in our lives which makes them seem even more believable. You know, that we go through with an underlying belief in our lives that I'm unlovable, or I'm worthless, or I'm inadequate, or, you know, I'm dependent, or I'm useless, or whatever, you know. All those beliefs we can carry. And the very fixed nature of those beliefs is suffering, actually. It's so, so painful. And sometimes awakening or liberation is sometimes described as waking up from beliefs. And somebody once said to me, when I could no longer describe myself, then the healing began. That when I could no longer describe myself, then the healing began. If clinging and identification is released, the mind and heart are liberated. They're not fixed anywhere. They're no longer defined by their contents, no longer confined in this role of the experiencer, the thinker, the victim, the listener, the doer. And the nature of our life, of course, our body and mind, it doesn't disappear because we don't cling. You know, we are the nature of our life, it continues to arise and pass. We're touched deeply by its richness. It teaches us, it engages us, yet we're never lost. This is not a complicated teaching. It's not some kind of secret initiation. We can see this so clearly in our own experience. I would encourage you to try and find the sense of I alone. Try and find the sense of I without a description. I don't make any sense without you. It's always I am. I am happy, I'm a woman, I'm a mother, I'm angry, I'm impatient. We never just see I. We always see I, the sense of self, with its description. The thinker and the thought come together. The experiencer arises with the sound, with the sight, with the sensation. I am defined by other, or by you. You are defined by how I see you. Our body and mind doesn't vanish if we stop the definitions. But life is not interrupted if we are able to see through the definitions. Life is not interrupted if we're able to see the emptiness of the descriptions, and arises and passes according to its own nature. What clinging does, it introduces a process that Stephen referred to this morning, this wonderful word, papancha. And papancha really is this proliferation, this abundance, this creation of thoughts and associations and feelings that run riot in the mind, that we describe ourselves by, that lead us to the conclusion to say, I am and you are. This is, it's so easy to see papancha. You know how many times we've sat here at night, and I know this is particularly touches you, the sound of the soldiers. Now, how much papancha has gone on around the sound of the soldiers? You know, if you've been in the army, you might have your own particular papancha about that. I mean, you might have really incredibly fond memories of being in the army. You know, you might be sitting there thinking, oh, I remember the good old days, somebody shouting at me, You might have absolutely horrible memories of being in the army, of people shouting at you and bullying you. You might sit there and think, what are they doing? And the whole long papancha about, about violence and all the rest of it. But it doesn't take much, does it, to get it going? It doesn't take a lot, just a little sound, and there it goes. And of course, sometimes it's quite wrong, isn't it? Sometimes we're again, the dog with the tumor. One night I was in bed, and I thought, oh, how nice, they're having a fireworks display over at the army camp. They were shooting machine guns. Suddenly woke up and said, I was thinking, oh, lovely, a little break, So they're having a nice, they're shooting machine guns. I thought, this is ridiculous, How are we so quickly, once we almost have a piece of papancha going, how often our questioning just stops. We don't see what's going on behind it, because we have this history that we're sticking with. It's so fascinating. I mean, one has to have a sense of humor about it, I mean, how many times we've done those stories and we wake up and we look back and we say, what was that all about? It's almost that we cannot believe ourselves. We cannot believe ourselves. We say, what was that all about? And yet, when we're in the middle of it, we could have written a book about it. We could have gone out and given a teaching on, how true all of this was. There's a poem I'd like to read you. It says, when I banged my head on the door, I screamed, my head, and I screamed, door, door. And I didn't scream mama, and I didn't scream God, and I didn't prophesy a world at the end of days when there will be no more heads and doors. When you stroked my head, I whispered, my head, and I whispered, your hand, and I didn't whisper mama or God, and I didn't have miraculous visions of hands stroking heads in the heavens as they split wide open. Whatever I scream or say or whisper is only to console and comfort myself. My head, door, door, your hand, identification creates stickiness. But identification is also the active face of ignorance. Now, I need to spell that out a little bit, because when we use the word ignorance in this tradition, it's not an insult, please. I'm not trying to insult anybody. you know, it's not used in this to imply a kind of absence of knowledge or that somebody's kind of stupid or something. Ignorance simply means misunderstanding reality. And clinging is the active face of ignorance. And sometimes ignorance is defined as mistaking pleasure for happiness, believing that pleasure and happiness are the same thing. Ignorance is just defined as seeking for permanence and continuity when there is only impermanence. And ignorance is believing there to be a solid entity of self, of me, when there may be no such thing. And ignorance gets us into trouble, basically. When we mistake pleasure for happiness, that means that we go through life in this futile task of trying to get rid of the unpleasant and trying to have more of the pleasant, believing that if we're successful in doing that, we will be happy. Anybody find that possible? You know, one time I was teaching a retreat for small children in America, you know, and we were having a little bit of a discussion on craving, on wanting, on desire. And I said to the children, I said, what do you think happens to you if you go through life always wanting more and more and more? You know, and they kind of sat there for a while and so on. And then this little five-year-old boy, he pipes up and I said, what do you think you get? What do you think happens? He says, trouble. True, huh? A lot of difficulty comes into our lives when we're trying to make things last, when their nature is to change. You know, try to make the pleasant experience last. Trying to make the wonderful sensation last. Trying to maintain things that are bound to change, a good deal of difficulty comes into our lives. You know, Suzuki Roshi once said that renunciation is not getting rid of the things of this world, that renunciation is accepting that they pass away. Even more difficulty comes into our lives when we go through life living within the boundaries of a definition, a conclusion, an image that we insist on being. Because then we insist on everybody else being someone also. Now I think sometimes when we do wake up to how much difficulty comes through clinging, and through that, especially clinging to the notion of self, that sometimes there's almost a feeling of wanting to join a kind of anti-self club, you know, of how do I get rid of the self? How do I eradicate it? How do I annihilate the self? This is also actually not necessary, I must say. And that takes up a lot of time trying to modify ourselves. Have you noticed that in life? How busy it makes us trying to improve ourselves. So tiring. You know, trying to be a better self. It's exhausting. You know, and we never seem to get there, do we? You know, and then we seem to take little steps and then, oh gosh, you know, then we fall down again. You know. So exhausting. And it's so unnecessary. You know, the Buddha once said, I teach about self, I also teach no self. And I also say there is nothing which is either self or not self. This is the mystery of emptiness, just to let go of all fixed ideas, to have no positions, to understand that nothing can actually get in the way of emptiness, that there is nothing to get rid of. There's a wonderful poem. Oh, it's not a poem. There's a wonderful thing I wanted to read you by a great Zen teacher. He said that gaining enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon doesn't get wet. The water isn't broken. Although its light is broad and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the whole sky are reflected in one dewdrop on the grass. Enlightenment doesn't destroy the person, just as the moon doesn't break the water. The person doesn't hinder enlightenment, just as a dewdrop doesn't hinder the moon in the sky. The depth of the dewdrop is the height of the moon. The time of its reflection, long or short, proves the greatness of the dewdrop and the vastness of the moon in the sky. We're tempted to try and make something out of emptiness, or to try and make something out of enlightenment. And then it becomes something that we chase, that we try to get, that we search for. Sometimes that we try to make it into nothing, and then we risk sinking into kind of spaciness and sloth. You know, this is the great paradox, the great mystery of meditation, I think, that sometimes we're encouraged to sit and to make heroic efforts until we sweat beads. Other times we hear that there will come a time when we will look back on our heroic efforts to become someone as futile actions performed in a dream. This is a kind of mystery we're asked to embrace. Of course we make efforts in this practice. We make efforts to understand. We make efforts to undo things. You know, we make efforts to be clear. We make efforts to be awake, to let go. But we mustn't make too much effort. We mustn't try too hard. I think sometimes it's helpful to think of awareness as a kind of mirror. And the light of awareness reflects everything that comes into the mirror. The mirror doesn't have any preferences or likes or dislikes. It reflects everything equally. And when we look more closely into the mirror, when we really study and look more closely into the mirror, things do become clearer. Everything comes and it goes into the mirror. The mirror doesn't go out seeking for things to reflect. But the nature of the mirror, the nature of awareness, is actually stillness. That sights and sounds and thoughts and ideas, they all arise and pass in stillness. They arise and pass in awareness. When nothing comes into the mirror is equally happy. It reflects nothing. It reflects itself. When we begin to see and to understand that quality of awareness in our own experience, the whole my part, the clinging part, begins to be released. We begin to sense that stillness, that nothing better, nothing worse, that sometimes awareness reflects something, sometimes awareness reflects itself. And all things spring from that stillness. All things are born from that stillness. We might call it the ground of being, or we might call it the liberated mind. We might also wonder what happens if even the mirror cracks and there is no thing and no thing to reflect, and at the same time there is everything. The Buddha once said that the sign of the liberated mind is that it is unshakable and it is immeasurable. Immeasurable. And it is the highest of all happiness. I wanted to read you another poem from Nagarjuna. And actually, actually, in these poems of Nagarjuna, I could actually read you any of them, because they're all about emptiness. So nice about them. I've never had a whole book of poetry on emptiness. This one is called Life. Is life what drives me, whether constant or fleeting? Drives are not alive like life. How am I alive? When I cannot be found inside this mind or body, who is there to be alive? If I survived by clinging on to thoughts and feelings, how could I change? Without clinging or evolving, who can be alive? If I came and went, how could I be freed? If clinging binds, I who cling would be unbound. Like those who do not cling. How is it I am trapped? Neither bound nor unbound are free. Were the bound to be freed, freedom and bondage would be simultaneous. I am free, I cling no more, liberation is mine. The greatest clinging is to cling like this. What do you think of a freedom that never happens? What do you make of a life that won't go away? If we could just have a couple of moments quietly together.